ago that only about one-tenth of Americans would have self-identified as not being religious. That percentage has doubled in a very short period of time, and it's now about one-fifth. And I can only say that because I haven't bothered checking in the last month or two. It's growing very quickly. Skepticism is growing mostly, of course, among young people. And troublingly, especially young men by a 2-to-1 margin over women. So young men especially appear to be susceptible to the lure of non-religious, skeptical, agnostic, and atheist thinking. So it's an issue that we have to address, not just for people outside the church, but for people inside who may not stay if they come to the conclusion that they can no longer believe the Christian faith is true. So people need answers. Of course, some answers are better than others. I don't know if you can read that, but the top line says, answers, 75 cents. Answers requiring thought is $1.25. Answers that are correct are $2.50, and dumb looks are still free. Now, there are anti-intellectual forms of Christianity that do exist and that say that the whole project of trying to give people reasons why they should believe something is a mistake. I'm going to probably step on a toe or two, but I'm going to risk it here, and I'm going to quote Joyce Meyer from her book Battlefield of the Mind for Teens. She is an enormously popular Christian author and speaker in our country today. And she said, and I quote, "I once asked the Lord why so many people are confused, and he said to me, 'Tell them to stop trying to figure everything out, and they will stop being confused.' I have found it to be absolutely true. Reasoning and confusion go together," end quote. Now that is a frightening statement. The Bible actually encourages what we might call a moderate kind of skepticism. Here I'm using the term skepticism to mean refusing to believe something for no reason whatsoever, just accepting whatever you're told. The Bible's term for this is being naive or simple-minded. Proverbs 1:22 was one of many statements in the book of Proverbs criticizing those who are naive or simple-minded. "How long, O naive ones, will you love being simple-minded? And scoffers delight themselves in scoffing, and fools hate knowledge." Knowledge is not a bad thing. Knowledge is not a dirty word. Reason is not a dirty word. Being simple-minded and gullible and easily fooled into believing something, that's what we want to avoid. That's what is happening to many people when they are hoodwinked by clever-sounding arguments into junking the Christian faith. Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 5:21, just in case you're wondering if this is still a valid principle for Christians, Paul says in 1 Thessalonians 5:21, "Test everything. Hold fast to what is good." I will admit to being somebody who has taken that "test everything" very seriously. I question everything. I have questioned everything in my life that I've come across, and I've always asked, how do I know this is true? I'm going to stick to my guns and say there's nothing wrong with that. The question is not whether we should test what we are told. The question is, why are we testing it? Are we testing it because we want to know what's true? That's good. Are we testing it because we're looking for a way out? That's not so good. We should never be afraid of hard questions. Now let's talk about Christianity and some of the basic claims that it makes. Let's first talk a little bit about the Bible. The antiquity of the Bible is not in dispute. At least I say that. I have met one person in my life who claimed that the Bible was written, I think he said, in the 18th century. And I said, you know, even the King James Version is older than that. There was nothing I could say to persuade him otherwise. But, you know, I don't know what he'd been smoking that morning, so and this was in California, yes, you guessed correctly. So for all I know, you know, he's an outlier. But most people understand the Bible is a collection of ancient books and they've come down to us over the centuries really quite intact. The Bible has a paper trail about as long as you could ask for in books written so long ago. The paper trail dates from the 6th century B.C. for the Old Testament and from the 2nd century A.D. for the New. Now, to put that in some perspective, the Old Testament books were finished around the 4th century B.C., and all of the New Testament books were written in the 1st century A.D. So that's a very close window of time between the earliest copies that we have and when the books were actually written. Now you say, well, but that's a century or 2 centuries or even more. Listen, for ancient literature, having books, copies of books that were written within 500 years is a rarity. It's more commonly 1,000 years or 1,500 years. Our earliest copies of Homer's works, the Iliad and the Odyssey, the earliest copies, complete copies of Homer, date from probably about 1,500 years after Homer. And that's not unusual. So we actually have an amazingly good supply of documentary evidence for the text of both the Old and the New Testaments. By the way, in case you're wondering what the little silver-looking things there on the left are, those are some silver scrolls that contain a part of the Old Testament, specifically the priestly benediction from Number 6, verses 24 to 26, in Hebrew, and it dates from the 6th century B.C. That's our oldest textual copy of any portion of the Old Testament. Most scholars studying ancient and classical literature would just be ecstatic if they had something that close to the original source. To accept the Bible, you don't have to trust any one man. Anyone can go look at the manuscripts and study the original language texts. This is a friend of mine, Dr. Dan Wallace, examining some actual papyrus sheets of the New Testament. He's a scholar who actually goes all over the world and produces high-quality photographs of manuscripts that are in danger of not being legible anymore, or in some cases weren't even known about until he found them, and taking very high-resolution photographs of these manuscripts. Translations of the Bible can be checked. People say, well, how do you know the Bible's been translated correctly? Study Hebrew and Greek, and you can look for yourself. You don't have to take anybody's word for it. That's my point. It's not like, if I may smuggle this in here, it's not like the case with the Book of Mormon that Joseph Smith produced, where you say, well, what did it say in the original Reformed Egyptian? Nobody knows, because there is no Reformed Egyptian text to look at. You have to take his word for it. You never have a problem like that with the Bible. You're never stuck having to take one person's word for something tremendously important you can't do without it. Nothing like that. It's a real blessing and privilege to have something like the Bible, where the testimonies are multiplicity of testimonies to the same core truths over and over again. And anybody with the desire and the willing to put in the effort can check it all out for himself or herself. The Bible is not purely a subjective opinion or somebody's spiritual experience that could be valid for them, but you don't really know, because again, you have to take their word for it. But it's based on God, the creator of the universe, acting in history. Let me give you some examples from other religions. Hinduism originated in polytheistic ideas that go back even before the time of Moses, but in India. And these polytheistic ideas are generally not accepted even by today's Hindus. But it's rooted in a very superstitious form of polytheism and idolatry that educated Hindus, even in India, generally do not accept. And it's not based on anything historical or factual. It's simply a religious group of traditions that originated many, many thousands of years ago. And our earliest documents that relate to those date from thousands of years after that started. Buddhism ultimately rests on the teachings of Gautama, who was called the Buddha, the Enlightened One, and all of his teachings were based on his own subjective experience. He had a religious or spiritual experience, and he told people what they should believe based on his experience in his mind. Nothing happened in the external world that anybody else could look at. He just said, this is what I found within myself. If you look within yourself, you can find it too. That's the message. Well, if it appeals to you, and if you look for it hard enough in yourself and find it, you might be persuaded. But this is a different kind of faith than the biblical faith, where actual facts are put out there that could be confirmed or disconfirmed if somebody took the effort to actually investigate the facts. The Quran, the holy book of Islam, is a collection of religious and moral sayings of one man, Muhammad, who thought he was receiving revelations from God. Now, of course, Muslims adamantly insist that he was. Even Muhammad wasn't sure at first. At first, he wasn't sure if he was hearing from God or from some kind of malicious demon. His family actually persuaded him to take the revelations seriously, and he eventually accommodated himself to the idea that these were divine revelations. But it's strictly something that was in his head. And Muhammad had a lot of good things to say, but it's just Muhammad. The Bible, on the other hand, is based on actual events in history that display the power of God over life, death, and nature, and demonstrate that he is the one true God. So in the Old Testament, the entirety of the Old Testament, really, as the scripture of the Jews, of Israel, is based on historical claims about what the Lord God of Israel did in the Exodus and in the conquest that proved that he was God, that he was the God of nature, the God of the heavens and the earth, that he led them out by his power. If that didn't happen, Judaism is false. So it's an important question. But this is the nature of the Bible, that it makes statements that you can actually grab onto and test and think about and wrestle with, not just, well, that's a nice opinion that he has. The New Testament is, of course, founded on the teachings, death, and resurrection of a real human being, Jesus of Nazareth. And these events were attested by multiple witnesses, and they are confirmed as divine because they fulfill biblical prophecies in what we call the Old Testament. So these are all objective claims that the Bible makes that can be examined and even to a great extent tested by people who want to know, is this really true? The basic physical historicity of the Bible is fact. Here's a map of the Old Testament world, and there's a lot of places that are mentioned in the Old Testament, they're actual places that you could go, even to this day, if there are no political boundaries that might prevent you, and you can go visit these places and you can see for yourself, and you can find numerous evidences showing that these places and the events described in these places were actual in the ancient world. Outside sources verify many of the individuals mentioned in the Bible. Old Testament kings of Israel, such as David and Ahab, Ahaz, Jehu, and others. Foreign rulers that are mentioned in the Bible because they had some impact on the history of Israel, such as or the life of Jesus, such as Darius, Augustus Caesar, Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate. These are real people that we know about from outside the Bible. New Testament figures such as Jesus and John the Baptist and James, the brother of the Lord, and Caiaphas, the high priest, are mentioned in outside sources such as the writings of Josephus, and in some cases there are archaeological discoveries that have confirmed some of these people, notably Caiaphas. There is excellent evidence for the Bible's core claims that we've already touched upon. There is evidence, for example, for the Creator. Now, here's the way scientists are supposed to think. Here's how science is supposed to work. You make a prediction, then you examine the evidence to see if it supports your prediction. If it confirms your prediction, you're on to something. If it contradicts your prediction, you need to scrap your assumption that you started off with. You need to scrap that theory because or hypothesis because it has been disconfirmed by the evidence. That's how science is supposed to operate. Well, in the late 19th century, naturalistic science, in the beginning of the 20th century, naturalistic science predicted that as the telescopes got bigger, and they were getting much bigger and could see much further, that as science explored further and further out, we would never come to the end of it, that the universe was infinitely large and infinitely old, which meant that it simply exists. It's a self-existent reality. It wasn't brought into existence. It didn't have a beginning. That was the prediction. And it was the prediction because this is what the naturalist wants. He wants to be able to examine the physical world as if it is self-explanatory. In the 20th century, something very disturbing happened. They ran up against the boundaries, both in space and time, of the universe. They discovered that the universe is extremely large and very old and yet finite in both size and age. Now, it almost doesn't matter how old it is. The fact that it had a beginning was a devastating revelation for modern science, for the naturalist. And not only did the universe have a beginning, but it had a very, shall we say, satisfactory beginning, because the beginning did not simply last for a few seconds and then the universe implode on itself, but the universe expanded and created an environment in which it was possible to have interesting things like stars and planets and water and dogs and cats and people. Stephen Hawking, not a Christian, not a theist, said, "The odds against a universe like ours emerging out of something like the Big Bang are enormous." Hawking's main objection to Christianity is the problem of suffering, a problem with which he, of course, was intimately familiar. Naturalistic science predicted that life could originate spontaneously with ease here, and if it's easy, it could happen in thousands of other worlds. So they expected that as the telescopes got bigger, they would find more and more planets out there where there was evidence of water and evidence of life and even extraterrestrial civilizations. Hence the encapsulation of that belief and that hope in numerous science fiction books and television series and films, all predicated on the idea that life could spontaneously arise in thousands of places throughout the cosmos, which makes for great theater. It turns out not to be factually plausible in the least. What science has found is that there are dozens of conditions that must be just right for life to exist and survive anywhere in the cosmos. You have to have the right kind of star. You have to have the right kind of planet. The right kind of distance from the star so it doesn't get burned to a crisp or just stay cold and lifeless. And it has to be a stable planet in a stable orbit around the star for long enough that you can develop something like a rich biosphere and lots of living things and even a civilization that can last for thousands of years. All of that requires passing through a number of different criteria or standards of measurement in various categories, having certain things in place that have to be just right. You know, like Goldilocks' favorite porridge. It's not too hot, not too cold, but it's just right. And if it doesn't pass all of those criteria, you can't have a civilization of beings who could debate whether there is life on other planets. This is what led two agnostic scientists, Peter Ward and Donald Brownlee, to write a book called Rare Earth, in which they grudgingly admitted that complex life, that is life like us, beings that can think and debate and travel and so forth, is extremely uncommon in the universe. That there's even one planet with life like that is surprising, according to these two scientists. By the way, they explicitly disavow and reject the idea of a god being responsible for this phenomenon on the assumption that if we're talking about a being who's just incredibly smart and incredibly powerful. They never even entertain the possibility of an all-knowledgeable, all-wise, and all-powerful creator. It doesn't even enter into their thinking about the subject. Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of the molecular structure of DNA, said, and I quote, "An honest man armed with all the knowledge available to us now could only state that in some sense the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost a miracle. So many are the conditions which would have to have been satisfied to get it going." He's only talking about the origin of life. Forget about evolution for the moment. We haven't even got any life unless these conditions that would have to be met are satisfied, which he says is just spectacularly surprising. Seems like almost a miracle. Well, maybe it is. Now, as somebody who is, by disposition or temperament, skeptical, asking questions, how do you know? If there is a clear case, an obvious path to a natural explanation for a particular phenomenon, such as lightning, we should go with that. But if after decades and millions of dollars of scientific research, we can't figure out how life could have spontaneously arose on the earth, we might want to start entertaining the possibility that it didn't arise spontaneously. Just maybe that should be introduced as a possible hypothesis. And in fact, there are non-Christian scientists who would agree with that. But their solution is alien beings from another planet seeded the life here. That just puts the problem off into a different planet. It doesn't solve anything. Now, if God does exist, though, if the evidence shows that there is a creator, then why is there evil? This has got to be up there in the top two or three questions that skeptics ask about Christianity. You see, the problem seemingly is this. If God is all-powerful, he could stop evil from happening. He could make it so there's no evil. If he's all good and all loving, he would want to stop people from suffering. He would want to stop evil. And yet there is evil. Bad stuff happens. So is God not all powerful? Is he not all good? Does he not even exist? Many skeptics have concluded, based on this reasoning, that the God of Christianity, the God of the Bible, and in fact the God of Judaism or Islam, for that matter, cannot exist. But this is a serious mistake. It treats the problem of evil as a how is this possible question rather than a why question, which is what it is. If there is evidence for a creator and yet there is evil, it is legitimate to ask why. It is not legitimate to throw out the evidence that there is a creator. That's not good reasoning. So if we have evidence from nature that God exists, that should say the evidence from nature, not the existence from nature. If we have evidence from our conscience that there are moral values, that there is a right and wrong, that there is good and evil, and if the evidence of our experience and history shows that something has gone wrong, that's what we should conclude. Not that the other evidence, the evidence for a God, the evidence for right and wrong or good and evil should be discounted. So the situation is complex. We're not talking about God simply creating a wonderful world in which everything wonderful happens and nothing bad ever happens. It's a more complicated story than that. Now, one way to think about this that can be helpful is a kind of hypothetical reasoning in which we ask the question, well, what kind of world would you like? Or what kind of world do you think God should have made if there is one? Now, what are your choices? Well, here are your main choices. First, you could have no world at all. So, sorry, you don't exist. Is that preferable to what we actually have? I don't think so. I like existing. Secondly, you could have a world with creatures who are not free to do good or evil things. They just do what they're programmed to do. Now, it could be entertaining, but there would be nothing uplifting, nothing noble about human beings. We would just be doing what comes naturally. So we wouldn't ever do anything really bad, but we also would never do anything really good. No heroes. No overcoming. Some people think that's preferable, but I don't. Third, we could have a world with creatures who are free to do evil, but no God to overcome the evil. If you're an atheist, I guess that's what you're going to have to say. But you know, the problem of evil isn't just the problem of why it exists. The bigger problem is what's going to be done about it. If there's no hope, if evil is just an incorrigible aspect of the way things are and it's always going to be this way, why fight it? Why try to overcome evil with good? Even non-Christians quite often feel compelled to want to make a difference in the world, but if they're atheists, why? Because your efforts are not going to make a lasting difference. Evil is always going to be with us. So in the very fiber of our beings is an awareness that's not a satisfying way of looking at life. Evil should be overcome. And if there is a God who made the world and who is shepherding it toward some conclusion, that is a possibility that the atheist doesn't take into consideration. Your fourth possibility is a world with creatures who are free to do evil, and in fact have done so, but in which God will overcome evil with good, eventually having creatures in it who were free to do evil, but now do nothing but good. So we get to where we want to be, a world with people just doing good, where only good things happen, but they're free. They actually want to do good. That's the kind of world the Bible says God has made. A world in which creatures are free to do good or evil, in which we have chosen to do evil, but in which God is at work to rectify the matter and bring about the best possible world in which only good exists. But we're not there yet. God is He's working on making that world. Romans 8:28, Paul says, "We know that God causes all things to work together for good to those who love God." If you want to live in a world where everything is right, you need to sign up with God's plan, with God's intention. He is working on making the world that way. Be part of the solution and not part of the problem. Right? Don't just curse the darkness, curse the evil, curse the bad things that happen, but recognize that God is actually doing something to, as he says in Revelation 21:5, making all things new. Now, one of the biggest questions that we need to address with regard to the Old Testament I've already touched upon. Did the Exodus and the conquest really happen? Now, on the one hand, there's no plausible reason for the Israelites to have invented a myth about their people originating from a mass exodus from Egypt. Why make up such a story? On the other hand, mainstream archaeologists generally deny that it happened. What are we supposed to think about that? Well, here's a typical statement of the problem from a Jewish writer, Chaim Potok, in his book Wanderings, History of the Jews. Now listen to this, pay attention to this, because it's going to be interesting. He says, quote, "The Nile turned to blood, frogs, vermin, and wild beasts swarmed over the land, boils affected men and beasts, animals and crops were destroyed, the sun no longer shone, firstborn children were slain, a multitude of slaves made good their escape." And then he says, "We know of it only from the Bible. Egyptian scribes tell us nothing of such an escape. About all this, the land of the Nile is silent." And this is in that book, Wanderings. Now, so he's saying there's no external corroboration for the Exodus in anything in Egyptian literature. The land of the Nile is silent about the Exodus. However, just one chapter earlier in the same book, Potok wrote this, quote, "The Nile turned to blood. Men thirsted for water. Plague stalked the land. The sun no longer shone. Crops failed. Men slew the children of princes. Wild beasts roamed the land." This was how later Egyptian literature described the two broken centuries that followed the disintegration of the Old Kingdom, end quote. Now, wait a minute. This sounds an awful lot like his description of the Exodus that he said is not found anywhere in Egyptian literature. Just 20 pages later, he's going to say it's not, you know, the land of the Nile is silent about this, but he's just described it, but he says it's the disintegration of the Old Kingdom. Well, the problem here is primarily matching the biblical chronology of the Exodus and conquest, that is, when these events took place, with Egyptian chronology, not whether the events actually occurred. There's plenty of evidence from Egyptian sources, archaeological and inscriptional sources, textual sources, that something very much like the Exodus took place in Egypt, with the plagues and everything. The problem is, it doesn't happen, according to archaeologists, when the Bible says it's supposed to happen, so they say it's something else. If you ignore the chronology question and just ask, do the Egyptians know about an event like this, the answer is definitely yes. You all right there? Another question I'd like to address briefly is, did Jesus really rise from the dead? Now, there's two lines of evidence, in effect, for the resurrection of Jesus, historically speaking. The first is the evidence for the empty tomb, and the second is the evidence for Jesus appearing to people after the tomb is discovered empty. So first, the empty tomb. Just two points I want to make here to illustrate the kinds of evidence that we have. According to all four of the Gospels, women were reported to have found the empty tomb before the men. They are the first disciples, the first followers of Jesus, to discover that the tomb was empty. Now, this is of interest historically to modern researchers who are looking into the question of the credibility of the accounts. Because if you're a first century Jewish Christian and you're going to make up a story about the tomb being found empty, you're going to have Peter or somebody reputable like that finding the tomb empty. Or maybe Nicodemus or Joseph of Arimathea himself. You know, it was Joseph's tomb. So that would make sense. If you're going to make it up, make it a good story. Is that what the gospel writers do? No. They have a bunch of females find the tomb empty. Now, from a 21st century perspective, the fact that they were women does not make their testimony any less credible. But it does to a first century person. Not only that, they make the leader of the women that show up at the empty tomb, Mary Magdalene, who was known to have been a former demoniac. You can hear him now. So, some crazy lady said the tomb was empty. Now, hopefully, we today can look at that and say, well, that doesn't matter. She was delivered from the demons, and the fact that she's a woman has no bearing on the matter whatsoever. What that tells us is the early church didn't make this up. They were stuck with this part of the story. And so this is how they told it when they actually narrated what happened. They told it like it happened. The women went to the tomb to anoint the body, and the tomb was empty. The second reason why we can know that the tomb was empty is that the earliest Jewish explanation that was circulated in the first century for the empty tomb was that the disciples had stolen the body. Now, it doesn't matter whether they are making this part up or not. The point is that the Jews acknowledged, agreed, admitted that the tomb was empty and they had to have an explanation for it. Well, the disciples stole the body. So what we have here at this point is very strong evidence that Jesus was laid in a tomb and that within a very short period of time, a few days later, the tomb was discovered empty, first by a group of women, and later that was confirmed by some of the men disciples of Jesus. And don't tell me the men wouldn't have gone to look. You know they would, or some of them would. So the empty tomb is, there's very strong evidence that that's fact. Now, then there are the evidences of the appearances. Some of the women saw Jesus according to the Gospels. Again, not something you would expect Gospel writers, men Gospel writers, to make up. Other disciples later on saw Jesus according to the Gospels. Paul, in 1 Corinthians 15, gives a recitation of the appearances that are important for his purposes, and it's clearly a list that's independent of the Gospels. For one thing, he doesn't mention the women. You understand why in his letter he thought it would be best just to skip over that part. He went straight to Peter and the other men disciples because they were the authoritative witnesses who were going around preaching the resurrection at the potential cost of their lives. So he starts off with Peter and the other disciples. But his list corresponds very closely in other respects to what you find in the Gospels. And yet, it's clearly independently derived. He didn't get it from any of the Gospels. Nor did the Gospels get the list from Paul. So we have independent testimonies from the Gospels and from Paul that Jesus was seen by Peter and by other male disciples of Jesus shortly after his death and burial. Paul, of course, also tells us firsthand about his own experience as an opponent of the Christian faith, being turned around by seeing the risen Jesus himself. Gives us an extended discussion about this point and how it changed him in Galatians chapter 1. Paul's story is very difficult to dismiss. He was a rabid opponent of Christianity, wanted to stamp it out, and then all of a sudden he stopped. And after the dust had settled, he emerged not only as a Christian, but as someone who was vigorously seeking to promote the gospel of Jesus to Gentiles, people that Jews in his day talked about as dogs. And they didn't think of dogs the way we do today, even. It was a demeaning way of thinking about non-Jewish people. And Paul wanted to have Christians brought into the church, and they didn't have to be circumcised, and they didn't have to keep the Torah, they didn't have to keep the food laws, and yes, you should even eat with those people. What could change a Pharisee who was very, and I'm not saying all Pharisees were like this, but Paul was a very self-righteous man who wanted to stamp out Christianity? What could make him turn around and become the apostle to the Gentiles and the person that wrote 1 Corinthians 13 about love? Something dramatically happened to that man. His testimony is that Jesus appeared to him. And that's the best explanation, I think, that we have. E.P. Sanders, a New Testament scholar, not an evangelical, said, and I quote, "That Jesus' followers, and later Paul, had resurrection appearances is, in my judgment, a fact. What the reality was that gave rise to the experiences, I do not know." End quote. Well, I do know. If the tomb was empty after the body had been laid there, and Jesus was then seen alive by various individuals, some of whom didn't even believe in him at first, the only explanation that satisfactorily accounts for both lines of evidence is that, in fact, Jesus did rise from the dead. It's the only explanation that actually works. Now, I want to conclude by giving you some recommendations for some reading that you could try to do over the next, I don't know, few months or year or 5 years, whatever fits your lifestyle and whatever you can perhaps change your lifestyle to accommodate, because reading is a vital part of our growth. And so I want to recommend 5 books that will help you to understand and defend the Christian faith. Now, somebody could come in here and give you another list of 5 that would be equally as good a list. So I do not pretend this is the definitive list. But I tried to give you some suggestions of the kinds of things that would be good for you to read. And you may pick out something from this list and say, hey, that sounds really helpful to me personally. And that's fine. You don't have to start with any particular one of these. And maybe you'll find something else that does the same thing in a way that works for you better. But I want to give you an idea of what's out there and what can really help us in our growth in understanding and defending Christianity. So first, here is a book edited by Wayne Grudem and a couple of other scholars, New Testament biblical scholars, called Understanding the Big Picture of the Bible, A Guide to Reading the Bible Well. Now, these are top-flight evangelical scholars who explain what's going on in the different parts of the Bible so that as you read through the Bible, you know where you are. It's like a mental map of the Bible so that when you're reading something in Leviticus or 2 Chronicles or Jonah or whatever it might be, you're not lost. You know what's going on. You know how this fits into the big picture of what's going on in the Bible. That is an understanding, a knowledge set that most Christians, even Christians who've read the Bible repeatedly, still lack. This book, something like this, would be very helpful for most of us in order to get the big picture of what's going on in the Bible. So I strongly and highly recommend this book as an example of such a resource. The second book I want to mention is Vishal Mangalwadi's book, The Book That Made Your World, How the Bible Created the Soul of Western Civilization. Now, I'll just be very honest with you. This might take you a while to get through. But it's not hard to read, but it just every chapter you're going to be stopping and thinking and meditating and chewing on what he says. Basically, Mangalwadi is an Indian Christian. I mean, from India, right? And he explains from kind of a cultural outsider's perspective, but as a believer, the positive influence that the Bible has had in human history, in practically every area of life. Music, arts, technology, science, medicine, morality, business, and many other areas. He does this in a way that's very culturally sensitive, but also really exposes how our society, Western civilization, is in danger of letting slip the very thing that gave us so many of the positive things in our culture that we value. It's a terrific book. I just can't highly recommend it enough. It's just a terrific read. You're going to learn a lot by working through even a good part of that book. Third, and there are so many books I could recommend in this area, but this is one that I think would be a nice, helpful place to begin. Evidence for God, 50 Arguments for Faith from the Bible, History, Philosophy, and Science, edited by William Dembski, who you may have heard of as one of the leaders in the intelligent design movement, and with Michael Lacona. This book has a really impressive lineup of Christian scholars writing on pretty much every subject of significance for defending the Christian faith. They're all very short chapters that get right to the point and cover a wide range of issues, and it's very helpful material. And they're short chapters, but you're really going to get a lot out of something like this, and this is the one that I would recommend. Now, the fourth book I want to mention is John Collins' book, Science and Faith, Friends or Foes. Now, there's no avoiding controversy in Bible science issues, but I'm going to go ahead and recommend a book anyway, because I think this is a very balanced, knowledgeable, insightful book on how Christians can think about Bible science issues. You're going to get a lot out of the book, even if you don't agree with them on some of the more controversial or debated topics. So I strongly recommend this particular book, or finding something else like it that will introduce you to the range of issues in studying this whole controversial matter of the Bible and science. Finally, a very practical little book by Greg Kochel. You may have heard of him. You may have heard him on the radio. He's a very popular Christian apologist. He's a friend of mine, and he's written a little book called Tactics, A Game Plan for Discussing Your Convictions. And in this book, what he does is he gives you a how-to, a kind of practical, here's how you actually talk to non-Christians about what you believe, and help them think through the issues. So he has content in it. It's not just the how-to, but the content is there to illustrate the method, to illustrate how you can engage people thoughtfully, respectfully, and constructively in talking about your faith. Well, I've gone just a minute or two over time, so I'm going to have to stop. But I just also want to mention our website one more time here. We have resources on studying the Bible that I think would be very helpful for you and on other subjects. So if you have a chance, visit us at irr.org. And thank you all very much for your attention. And that's, I'm done. How about we have a word of prayer? Are we going to have, do we have time for like a song or something yet?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I've gone a little over time. Let's have a word of prayer. Father, thank you for truth. Thank you that truth matters. Thank you that you have not simply left us to our own devices to figure out what to believe, but you've given us a revelation that has a paper trail of clues and facts and reality that backs up what it says. Thank you that you care enough about us to reveal yourself and to make a way for us to have a relationship with you. We thank you for what you are teaching us. Help us to continue and to grow in these areas. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.